Right, so I'm just going to talk about spectral models of accretion disks in black hole binaries specifically, and that's my list of collaborators. Okay, so I'm going to begin by talking about the motivation a little bit, why we're going to look at spectra and why black hole binaries in particular. I'm going to give an overview of black hole binary sources, some of their lore, brief introduction, discuss our models a little bit, and the stellar atmospheric calculations, which are sort of the primary component of the models. And then I'm going to try to address what we can learn or what we have learned from these models, compare some of our models to data, including some fits, and then I'm going to provide a summary and some prospects for future research. Okay, so why would we want to do this? What we want to do is understand the physics of luminous accretion disks. So some of the questions we want to ask is, how is energy transported? And how is energy transported vertically, and how is it dissipated? You sort of can't address these directly, but you can look at numerical simulations which can address this, and then incorporate the results of those numerical simulations into your models, and then see how they compare with observations, and try to get some constraints. That way, one thing we wonder about is how radiation MHC modes might affect the spectra. They affect the dynamics on some level. If they show up in the spectra, we can potentially constrain that physics. And then, of course, there's these global properties of the accretion flow, whether they're warps or if there's mass loss. Warps will affect reprocessing. We currently ignore self irradiation and reprocessing. If there's advection in the inner regions, that'll affect the spectrum. So we can sort of test all these things potentially with spectral models. Okay. So one of the things we wanted to do when we started this research project is to incorporate numerical simulations into our models. And so along those lines, we've been working with Neil Turner, and he's done these simulations where he zooms in on one patch of the accretion disk and models the full radiation MHD equations in a shearing box simulation. And so he's done this. We only have one simulation so far, which is the one I'm showing a plot of. And you can see in this plot here, we're plotting dissipation in the lower panel. And in this case, we're in the radiation pressure-dominated region of the accretion disk. And so by definition, radiation is providing the pressure support against gravity. And so in accretion disks, the gravity increases linearly with height. And so the flux also has to increase linear with height. So the dissipation is just the gradient in the flux. So the dissipation should be constant. At least below the radiation pressure scale height. And so this dotted line here shows the sort of standard thin disk model. And you can see that more or less it is constant with height. And so the solid curve is Neil's, is from Neil's simulation. This is time and horizontally averaged. And it's quite noisy, but you can see more or less it's consistent with constant dissipation. Okay. And so it's fairly common knowledge that in radiation pressure-dominated regions of thin disks, that the density is constant with height. And so this is basically actually just an assumption that, basically just due to an assumption made by Shakur and Tsunyaev in their original paper, which sort of stuck since, they just assumed that the dissipation scaled locally with the density. And sort of the flux, or the dissipation, has to be constant by definition, so the density has to be constant by definition. And there's no physics that goes into that assumption. Okay? So what Neil found in his simulation is that the density is actually much higher in the center and falls off sort of like a Gaussian and is much lower in the outer regions of the disk. So what you end up getting is you get much more dissipation in the low-density surface layers, or more dissipation at low column mass than in the standard thin disk solution. Okay, so why would we look at age? Why would, I guess when you think of spectral models, most people think of, I think, AGN first. And the reason for that is because the disk falls in the optical UV, so you have really good spectral resolution and signal to noise. You you can fit the break that's seen around the Lyman edge. That gives you a fairly strong test for your model. Of course, there's lots of observations or lots of sources to look at. But there's sort of some bad things, one of which is that we've sort of already done this. Of course, it's the first thing people do. And sort of we've had mixed results. And so actually, Omer and collaborators did made very similar models for black holes in this mass range. And what they found that was that the optical, in specific cases like 3C273, they get reasonably good fits. But in sort of a larger sample of observations, what they find is that the optical slopes are sort of too red for some of the inferred masses for these sources. That's sort of preliminary. Some of that may be due to additional emission. One problem with AGNs is that there's a lot of circumnuclear material, and that can contribute. There could be irradiation and reprocessing. And then a third problem is that you have a soft X-ray excess, and that doesn't come out naturally out of the models. So you have to invoke special physics to explain that. My favorite is turbulent compensation. But it's unclear how that an effect like that will affect the far ultraviolet spectra. So all those are problems with applying these models.
Can you remind me, in that 3C273 pit, was it a problem that you'd make almost no ionizing photons, if I'm remembering correctly?
Well, it was just a comparison of whether you could actually fit the continuum.
Right, but if it makes no ionizing photons, well, then the optical goes, you know, goes up and down with a broad line. So that suggests that the optical UV source is the same as the ionizing photon source, and the model makes
Yeah, I don't recall. I don't know.
But you're right. It doesn't extrapolate to the sub-X ray, so there are fewer ionizing photons.
Oh yeah. No.
Are there enough to
It definitely doesn't agree in the sense that it's not extrapolating to the sub-X ray.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that might be asking something that's more ambitious, maybe, but I think a fairer test is the ionizing photons, because those soft X-rays could be from a different but I would think that this model would have to produce the ionizing photons because the lines in optical UV continuum are so well correlated.
Right, but it does match the spectrum, lower to the long edge. So you do have ionizing photons. Anyway, I'm interjecting, Shane, because I feel like, you didn't do that work. I should shut up.
I think the main problem with the observation at the time was that the mass wasn't in agreement with the reverberation mapping mass, but they said it corrected the reverberation mapping mass, and Omer predicted the right one, to his credit. So why black hole binaries? Well, one of the advantages is that we know there's a disk there. Some people would claim we don't know that in the AGN case. You get most of the spectra you can get with a single instrument, at least most of the peak in UF nu. And because of because these things are binaries, you have independent measures of the black hole mass, inclination, and distance. Although to be fair, the distance is actually measured more poorly than in AGN, at least fractionally. And I think the main thing that I like about them, that you get long-term variability. You can see the same source, but at different accretion rates, and you're never going to get that with AGN. So that gives you, I think, potentially more constraining power. But of course, the bad thing is you have poor spectral resolution. The best detectors, Chandra and XMM, are limited by pileup. These are bright sources. The most prolific observatory only gives you spectral coverage down to 3 kV, so this actually doesn't apply. And there's not as many sources, but I don't really think that's actually too big of a problem. Okay, so before I go into the more complicated models, I think I should discuss what is essentially the simplest model that's worth talking about. It's commonly called the multicolor disk model. And so the way you get this is you just get a temperature temperature distribution for the surface of the disk. You just multiply some emitting area by a flux, relate that to the gravitational energy which is released, and that just gives you that the temperature goes as the radius to minus 3/4. And then so if you want to turn this into a spectrum, you have to assume something about the local emission. And what's commonly done is people just assume it's a diluted black body. And that's just a black body in which you shift the temperature to higher energy, or you shift the temperature to a higher value by a factor of this color correction. And so you're just moving the peak of the black body by a factor F call, and then you have to divide by this color correction to the fourth power to keep the normalization right. And so what's useful about this model is it's simple. It's basically only parameter. And then, of course, you can change your integration variable from R to T. But so what's useful about this model is that it's only determined by essentially three parameters: the inner temperature, this whole thing comes in as a normalization, and then the color correction. And so what's done in practice when you fit a model is they just assume the color correction is one, and then whatever they get for an inner temperature, they just correct it after the fact. And so if you also have an estimate for the distance to the source, the inclination, you can use that normalization to infer an inner radius. And if you also have the mass of the source, you can compare that inner radius to the gravitational radius. And so if that's less than the innermost stable circular orbit for a Schwarzschild black hole, people infer that there's a spin. And so there's a lot of uncertainties in doing that, the uncertainties in these parameters, and in, you know, what is the color correction, are there relativistic effects. So that's actually kind of looked down upon, I think, more recently, doing that sort of analysis. Okay, so unfortunately, I think I have to review some aspects of spectral formation because I have to get into some of these details. And so I'd just like to define this quantity, the depth of formation. And I'm just defining it as the optical depth where the effective optical depth, that's the electron scattering optical depth times the absorption optical depth, square root of that quantity, where that quantity equals unity. Okay, and so basically just what this means is that photons which are emitted from optical depths larger than the depth of formation are typically absorbed before they reach the surface. And photons which are emitted at lower optical depths can generally scatter out and escape to infinity. And so I'm talking about electron scattering dominated atmospheres here. So when you have coherent scattering and or temperature gradients, in general, what you expect to get out of the spectrum is a modified black body. And for constant temperature, it's just a normal black body, which is multiplied by this factor, which is frequency dependent, because at least in the case of free absorption, there's a frequency dependence. The electron scattering is constant. And so in general, the spectrum is harder and doesn't look like a black body. And so you can sort of see in this plot just sort of what effect that has on the spectrum. I stole this plot from Omer. So this is an integrated disk spectrum where, in this case, the spectrum in this dot dashed curve, the local spectrum is assumed to be black body. In the dashed case, it's assumed to be is a case where where you include the effects of modified black bodies. Well, they actually do a full stellar atmospheres calculation, but the point is they only use coherent scattering, and you can see it's significantly harder. Okay. Now, if you actually model the electron scattering correctly and you allow it to exchange energy with the photons exchange energy with the electrons, what you generally have is that sort of because there's temperature gradients in the atmosphere where the photons are emitted, it's actually hotter than at the photosphere, right? So as the photons scatter out, if there's a sufficient number of scatterings that they can exchange a lot of energy with the electrons are generally sort of cooler than the photon distribution, and so the photons will transfer energy to the electrons, and the spectrum will actually be softer. Okay, and so this solid curve just shows what you get with Compton scattering. You see that it is indeed softer. And so people have done careful modeling of this for black hole binaries, Shimura and Takahara, and what they found was that in most cases, the models were the cognization was scattering, was saturated, and so the spectrum did have sort of a Wien-type profile, and so a Wien-type profile is pretty well approximated by a diluted black body, and they found a color correction of about 1.7. So people have sort of been using this ever since.
Where are those two features coming from?
I think these. Well, so this actually has metal opacities in it too. This is probably some combination of, let's see, 10 to the 16. I think that actually might just be.
Actually, I don't think it does have
metal. Yeah. Oh, don't it? Well, what's this? Yeah, but this peak isn't due to metal opacities. I think it's just due to relativistic effects. Well, you know better than me. What?
Well, I mean, it's because you're not familiar with these frequencies, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, what would be? It's redshifted down from 3 × 10^15. Well.
Oh, so. So it's. What is it?
Yeah, so what is that? Yeah.
Wait, is this just the emissions? Wait, so it's redshifted?
It's edge. It's an edge.
Yeah, it's an emission edge.
They're hydrogen and helium.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an emission edge, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why they're not. Those are not very good for.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I don't really want to talk about AGN too much.
No.
Okay. So if I'm going to talk about black hole binaries, I need to talk a little bit about these states. There's basically three of them. One of them is a thermal dominant state. There's also a hard state and a steep power law state. But I don't have time to talk about them today. So I'm just going to focus on this thermal dominated state, which, as the name implies, is when the spectrum is assumed to be dominated by thermal emission from the accretion disk. Okay, and there's still some non-thermal emission. You can see this plot on the right. It's from RXT data, but in all these cases, the dominant component is this soft thermal component. And so on the right here, they also have power density spectrum. These states are basically defined by both their spectral properties and their variability properties. And I won't be talking about variability, but it's this state is just characterized by weak variability and the absence of QPOs. And because of that, it's often kind of considered a boring state. So I'll just talk about the boring state for the rest of the talk. So one of the things that's useful about these sources is that you have independent constraints from light curve modeling of the secondaries. So Arose was here, I think, over the summer and gave a talk on this. Some of you probably went to that. I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but basically you can see over here, this plot just shows his models. And so the disk is just a sort of simple hockey puck, and then they spend most of their time modeling the secondary carefully and then modeling the light curve of that. And so they draw rather tight constraints on the binary parameters. And so, for example, in the case of XT1550, something I'll talk about, a source I'll talk more about later, they get that the mass is about tensor masses plus or minus 1, the inclination is 72 degrees plus or minus a few, and of course, as I said, the distance is bad because it's just inferred from, I think, they infer a luminosity for the companion and then infer the distance from the flux. There's various uncertainties in that. Okay, so this plot, it takes a little bit of time to explain, but it's going to be important when it comes later. So this is work done by Gierlinski and Doan, who I'm starting to collaborate with now. So this motivated some of this work. So what they've done here is they've looked at several sources in the RXT archive that had multiple observations. And so what you see here is each of these red and black data points represents a different observation of the same source. And so what they've done is they've fitted this multicolored disk model to each observation, and then from that those fits, they've inferred the luminosity as a function of the Eddington luminosity. This is just for the disk component, and then they've inferred this maximum temperature. And so this maximum temperature is just related to the inner temperature in that multicolored disk model. There's a few correction factors they apply for the fact that there's relativistic effects. The temperature is not. Does not go as r to the minus 3/4, but also if you know, you also get the flux, and so if you know that if you have an estimate for the distance to the source and the inclination, you can turn that into a luminosity, and then if you also know the mass of the black hole, you can write that as a, or you can measure that as a fraction of the Eddington mass. And of course, there's lots of uncertainties in all those parameters. And so what these blue data points represent is it represents the uncertainties associated with these measurements. Okay? And so most of this uncertainty is dominated by the distance, I think, in most of these cases. Okay. And so this solid line, if everyone's with me, is what you get for a Schwarzschild black hole at the binary, assuming those binary parameters. Okay, if you had a Schwarzschild black hole in which the color correction was constant and equal to the 1.7 value of Shimura and Takahara. And so what's important about this is for this model, the luminosity just goes as the temperature to the fourth power. Okay? And so what you can see for several of these sources, they're more or less consistent with L going as T to the fourth. Okay? Some of these sources, it's actually a little bit hotter than that. And even 1550, which is sort of like L goes as L, where L goes as T to the fourth, sort of first order, you see a slight hardening in the spectra. Okay? So we can compare these curves to theoretical models, and though even though there's uncertainties in these values, the shape that these points, the locus of points mapped out, is robust to those uncertainties. Okay. All right. So Gulinski and Doan compared these with the existing spectral models, and they sort of got at best mixed results. Okay. So this is 1550. Again, it's sort of got the largest luminosity range. It's almost a decade and a half in luminosity. So you've chosen this one to compare. You can see the comparison with Shimura and Takahara, it's not bad, but you can't really say too much because you only get a few data points. And then there's another model, a similar model by Merloni and Fabian, which gets a very different result, which is not consistent with the data. Up here, they have saturated compensation, and things basically go as L, you know, L goes as T to the fourth. But at lower luminosities, because the temperature drops, the depth of formation is reduced, the number of scatterings goes down, and therefore compensation is no longer important. And so you get a modified black body spectrum. And so at a given luminosity, the spectrum is shifted to higher temperature, so it's harder. Okay, so they can't reproduce these results very well.
I'm confused by the Shimura and Takahara. Why are you doing only by stars instead of, it's just a fitting bond?
Well, so this comparison is actually sort of unfair because Shimura and Takahara just measured color corrections.
Yeah.
And so for a given luminosity model, Gulinski and Doan has just put the, given that color correction, this would be 1.7. at the luminosity that they put the model at. Right? So that's all that is. But the comparison is a little better with Merloni and Fabian because they actually include relativistic effects and do things in a more reasonable fashion. Okay. All right, so just want to briefly overview our models. This is sort of just a schematic to sort of demonstrate how they work. So what we do is we set up a grid, an impact parameter for an observer at infinity at a given inclination. And so at each point on this grid, we follow the photons back to the surface of the disk with full relativistic transfer, and then find the spectra at the disk surface, and then integrate over the emission by integrating over this grid. Okay, and we get the full disk spectra. Okay, so to get the spectrum at the surface, we need a grid of spectra at different annuli, which we can interpolate on. And so at each one of these discrete annuli, we do a stellar atmosphere calculation. Okay. And so the input for those stellar atmosphere calculations, we can find those inputs by solving the fully relativistic disk structure equations. Okay. And so this model is basically determined by five parameters: the mass of the black hole, the black hole spin, the inclination, the accretion rate, which we parameterized by the luminosity as a fraction of Eddington. It just differs by a factor of the efficiency. And then the alpha, which just relates the accretion stress to the total pressure. Okay?
These are quite static models.
Yeah.
And I know in the AGN case, that's kind of a bad thing because the variability, you know, mapping. You got that same problem with the X-ray binaries, that the variability is much faster than the viscous time scale, or doesn't matter or not? Is it in pink is also at all wavelengths, like in the AGN case, which makes it, again, hard to understand in a quasi-status model?
Well, is it actually really? I mean, I'm actually surprised it's that hard to understand AGN and quasi-static model.
Well, totally. I mean, they vary on.
They vary on more quicker than wait. They vary on the on. You're saying quicker than the viscous time scale.
Much. But quicker than the sound.
But even in the UV is the variability that substantial? That different from
totally.
The.
Yeah, they're layer of magnitude. And, you know, in the most constrained case, which is 5548, the conclusion based on reverberation mapping is that all the annuli have to communicate at older light speed.
Well, yeah, I mean, potentially some of that, I mean, I usually assume that most of that variability is potentially due to, or large fraction is due to reprocessing, but maybe that's crazy, I don't know. Well, I mean, certainly there's problems, potential problems in X-ray binaries, right? I mean, these things are, you know, we're only seeing them in outbursts, right?
So what's the amplitude of the variability in the thermal state?
Well, it's low relative to the other states, right. but I'm not sure.
When you just say RMS variability, it's not that high, is it?
No, I mean, well,
exactly.
But I guess I've never really thought about it in detail in comparing that to.
Well, if you go back to the previous one, the variability factor of view, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, that's secular. That's a different variability.
Yeah.
That variability.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead. You should say it. I mean, along those plots, when luminosity is changing, that's on
long time scales.
That's a long time scale.
Yeah, another way to say it is when you ask the question, what's the variability amplitude, you have to say it went over what time.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the power density spectrum you were showing, where flickering, if you will, which is on the orbital period of the viscous.
Yeah, so I don't think it's a big problem, but.
Why does the spectrum depend on alpha? Is that because some of the dissipations is near the photosphere?
It comes in through so alpha basically determines the surface density. Okay, and
you're sensitive to density.
Yeah, and well, it potentially.
Right? Yeah, okay.
It should in principle depend on alpha.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I still haven't answered my question.
Yeah, well, I'll answer that. I will get to that. I will get to that hopefully, but I have to hurry along. I'm getting a little bit behind, but so what I just want to say is that this is actually slow. Calculating each annulus individually takes. At least a half an hour, and if any of them go bad, it could take days, right? So this is, if you want to calculate lots of models, this is not the way to do it. What you'd prefer to do is calculate a big grid in the parameters that determine these annuli, and then interpolate on that grid, at least if you want to calculate a lot of models. So we've done that. We've constructed a grid in the parameters of interest, which I'll get to in a second. Okay, so I just was briefly going to overview the difference between these stellar atmospheres calculations in disks versus stellar envelopes. In stellar envelopes, the spectra are basically just determined by the flux and the local gravity and the composition, at least first order, for normal stars. So for annuli, they're a little more complicated. You still need to know the flux through the surface. Gravity is now proportional to the height, so you need to know the proportionality constant, which is just square of the capillarian frequency in Newtonian disks. The midplane column mass, the composition, and then because we have dissipation throughout the annulus, we need to make some assumption about how that dissipation is distributed, and we just parameterize that as a flux as a function of column mass in our models. And so T effective, Q, and the midplane column mass are all determined from these radial structure equations. And then the standard assumption, as I said, is DFDM is constant. So this is equivalent to saying that the dissipation is locally proportional to the density. Okay, so one of the main differences between our models and the models that I showed you of Shimura and Takahara, Merloni and Fabian is that we include boundary opacity. So I have to kind of explain this. This will take, I'll just follow along. The focus on this second plot here. So here I just plotted the opacities as a fraction of the total opacity. And you see that the electron scattering opacity dominates. That's the red curve that, as advertised, it dominates. The blue is the boundary opacity, and then purple is the free opacity. And what's important here is that the boundary dominates above about 2 keV. Okay? And so what this means is, and these are all evaluated at the depth of formation. So what this means is that the depth of formation, which is plotted in this third panel, it basically plateaus about 1 keV. Now, if we hadn't included the boundary opacity, this would continue to go up. Okay? So if we estimate the Y parameter, which is sort of an estimate of how important compensation is, it's proportional to the number of scatterings, which is proportional to this, roughly to this depth squared. And so because we limit this depth by having the boundary opacity, you can see our Y parameter here never gets to be above unity. So compensation never is so important that it's determining the spectrum. And so we don't get necessarily a Wien-type spectrum, okay? But if you look at, and that's, remember, is what all these arguments, Shimura and Takahara, that this diluted black body is appropriate, depend on these Wien spectra. And so if you look at our spectra from this annulus, which is the red curve, I've plotted a diluted black body spectrum next to it, and this is a log plot, so that the agreement probably is amplified, but you can see they actually match really well. So that's a bit surprising, because for a modified black body, as I said earlier, the frequency dependence of the absorption opacity generally gives you a shape which is different than what you'd expect to be represented by a single temperature. Okay, but as you can see in this the plot of the opacity here is relatively flat. Okay, I mean this is a log plot, but approximately it's roughly gray. And so what happens in this modified black body spectrum is that this value here is approximately constant, so it's as if you're just shifting the Planck spectrum over by a factor, which is roughly parameterized by color correction. Okay.
Responsible for the majority of the boundary opacity
level? Well, actually, everything is contributing in here. So iron is contributing a lot here, but you know, silicon, sulfur, iron again down here. A little bit of oxygen. So we include a lot of, most of the abundant metals, and so they all sort of contribute a little bit. Iron's the dominant one at these temperatures. Okay, so I don't have time to talk about this in detail, but this is just a plot showing how our annuli depend on the effect of temperature, how the spectra vary.
Let me make sure I understand the sign, though. So you'll have, in general, higher energies, you will have less extreme enhancement of the high energies compared to what they have if they didn't have the capacity then. At 5 kilovolts, your optical depth is now much higher in the atmosphere than you would have found if you just kept in free.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So you're not as harder, your spectrum's not as harder at high energies.
Yeah, it's less hard than if we would have had a modified black body with
right,
the free
right.
Yeah. So it's still softer. Yeah. No, that's right. And it also depends on the gravity parameter. I don't have time to talk about that, but I'd like to focus on the column mass here real quickly.
Just a quick question. What is the typical log G for the binary disk?
Oh, what's the gravity?
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, it varies a lot, right? Depending on, it goes, the Q goes as R to the minus 3. So in the inner regions, you can get Qs of, Q values of like 10 to the 8. So you have to multiply by a factor of H, which is around 10 to the 5, so G, I guess, is around 10 to the 14. That's way too high. It's got to be lower than that.
I'm wondering if it matches any star.
I'm not sure. Let me see if I can do this calculation. Right. Yeah, maybe I should go on. I can tell you later. I don't usually think in terms of the G. I usually think in terms of the Q parameter. But it should be straightforward. Actually, sorry. So this is a plot of the column mass, which Lars asked about. And so you can see for these first three plots, These are called masses of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 4, and 10 to the 3 grams per centimeter squared. And they all sort of lie right on top of each other. The spectrum doesn't depend on them. And then this plot is about 300 grams per centimeter squared, and this is about 100 grams per centimeter squared. And so what happens is that suddenly the spectrum hardens above a certain column mass. Does anyone have a guess as to why that would be? This is where the spectra go effectively thin. Okay, and as soon as they go effectively thin, the temperature goes up rapidly.
That's for a low density column, that's right?
Yeah, as you go to low column, they become effectively thin. Okay, this is just a comparison of dissipation profiles. I guess I can go over this briefly. So what we've done, this is a plot of ignore the top panel. This is a plot of the normal model with the standard Chikura-Tsunayev assumption about the dissipation. And that's the solid curve. And then we've sort of taken a dissipation profile motivated by Neel's simulation. Unfortunately, Neel's simulation is for AGN, but we've sort of scaled it down. So it's the best we could do at the moment. And so you can see it does change the density and the temperature. I mean, the density structure significantly, the temperature structure to some degree. You get a large temperature inversion. But these squares here show the optical depth unity, and then these triangles show the depth of formation. And what you should note is that in this plot, the temperatures at the depth of formation are roughly the same, and the densities are roughly the same. Okay, and so what that means for the spectrum is that the actual spectrum for the two different dissipation profiles is very similar. The modified dissipation profile is only slightly harder. So at least in this effectively thick annulus case, this dissipation profile doesn't have a lot of effect, which is kind of good or bad depending on how your point of view. Okay, so I just want to compare. So we have this new method, or we have two methods for calculating these disk spectra. One is where we do an exact calculation at each annuli, and then we interpolate between those exact calculations. And then one is where we do two interpolations. We interpolate on a grid of annuli in temperature, gravity parameter, and column mass to get the discrete annuli spectra, and then we interpolate between those. Okay, and so that the method where we use the interpolation is thousands of times faster. Okay, once you have the grid, you can calculate these at a rate of about 10 per second, right? And so this is useful if you want to actually use these for fitting. If you want to construct a table model, you need hundreds of thousands of spectra. Okay, and so it's the only way of doing this. So this is just a comparison of the two models. The exact curves are blue on this plot, and the interpolation method is shown by the red curves. And at high luminosities, they agree almost perfectly. And then they get a little there's a little problem in the tail at lower luminosities, and that's just because the effective temperature is getting low here. Those edges that you saw in the plot I showed briefly are becoming more important, and it's sort of harder for this interpolation method to capture that. Okay, but for the most part, I'm pretty happy with the agreement. Okay, so we can construct these models, these spectral models. We can construct a lot of them. So when I made these plots, our grid in effective temperature only went down to 10 to the 6. And so we could really only go to about 1 keV. Okay, I've since got it down to more like 10 to the 5, and so we can actually calculate spectrum out to 0.1 keV now. Okay, but for what I'm talking about for today, we're just fitting RXT data, and so it's important to note that RXT only covers down to 3 keV. Okay, and so what you should note in these spectra is that if you only get down to 3 keV, and you're fitting for each of these parameters simultaneously, there's a lot of degeneracy in these parameters. So it's important to have priors, like an estimate for the mass and the inclination at the very least. Okay? You can see, this one interesting about these plots, you can actually see how, even though you can't necessarily see the edge, the iron K alpha edge in these spectra, it actually shows up in the plot. That's kind of neat. And I really don't have too much time to talk about these unless there's questions. Okay, so one of the things we can do with these grid is we can create artificial spectra with these models. Okay, and so once we have an artificial spectrum, we can exactly repeat the procedure that the observers use on the real data, okay? And do exactly what Gierlinski and Doan did. And so what I've plotted here is that where they is the green plots are 1550, the same source I showed before. And so I've calculated models for spin zero, an inclination of 70 degrees and a mass of 10, and you recall those are close to the binary parameters for 1550. And so the red curve here is alpha equals 0.1, and the purple curve is alpha equals 0.01. You can see they agree well at lower luminosities, okay? But at the high end, the red curve hardens, right? And this is just, as I said, that alpha determines the column mass, and so a larger value of alpha gives you lower column masses, okay? So the models become effectively thin sooner, and that causes a hardening at lower luminosities, whereas the alpha equals 0.01 model follows this L proportional to T to the fourth for longer to higher luminosities. Although you can see it's starting to curve over a little bit.
So for the power law you have plotted on the back, what's the variable that's changing?
Okay, so this is a variation in the color correction. So the color correction is increasing this way as you go to the right, okay? And so this, I think, is like 1.8, and this is 2. Okay, so these things fall mostly between 1.8 and 1.2. But anyway, the thing I want to point out is our purple curve goes right through the data. Okay, and so it's sort of promising that, you know, these simple models seem to be able to reproduce the data. And we didn't even try very hard. I mean, we just put in the binary parameters. And it's actually, the agreement's almost too good.
So how much does the t-effective change on a Shakira Sinaia disk at each analy for the change in alpha?
The only parameter that alpha affects in the accretion disk is the surface density or the column mass, midplane column mass, in the standard model.
And your inner boundary condition, what's the torque condition?
These are all no torque. I looked at including a torque, but not for these models.
I assume right
in
the top right corner is where the torque issue comes in.
It's everywhere. If you had a torque, or if you had spin, right, you basically get a harder spectrum at the same luminosity, and so it shifts to the right.
Yeah.
Okay, and you know that's going to be important. So this is sort of an rather arbitrary way of comparing the data, right? I mean, I've made these complicated models, and so I'm comparing with the data by fitting a really simple model to both, right? And so that's kind of a strange thing to do. Oh, actually, I should just for comparison, this was the previous model. So we're actually doing reasonably better as far as that goes. But anyway, this is sort of an odd way of comparing the two. So we can well, before I show that, so what I really want to do is fit these. Well, I mean, this is crazy. This is actually crazy if you think about it, right? I mean, you would expect some degree of hardening as the things get hotter because the electron scattering becomes more important relative to the absorption. It's sort of.
But look at those green points on the left. Yeah. Why are they way down there? I mean, that's quality.
Oh, these are different color correction curves. These are the same. These are the same
data.
Oh.
Why do we disagree with these?
Oh, why do we agree down here?
Two sigma misses.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I would be skeptical about all of this actually. Down at the low end, the problem with the low end is that RXT only goes down to 3 kV, and so you're measuring even though these are disks, so the inferred disk luminosity is greater than the luminosity in the non-thermal component, but in the RXT band, it's dominated by the non-thermal component. So I wouldn't trust anything at the low end of the machine. Okay, so I want to fit this to data, and so I just got the data yesterday. Okay, so I spent all of yesterday fitting this data, and so I have been known to do observation before, but usually when I do it, I'm much more careful than I was. So you know, I was careful yesterday, but you know, anyway, preliminary fitting results. Let's put it that way. Okay, so this is 1550. On its five observations of 1550. Again, as I pointed out, the key for these sorts of things is that we're getting, you know, the same source at different accretion rates, and hopefully that's what's going to give us more constraining power. Okay, and so This is just a plot of the photon, the counts per second per keV, and this is sort of shows you what the sort of typical chi-squared from these fits are. And so this plot has the response in it still. The last time I gave a talk at UCSB and I showed a plot like this, Ski yelled at me. So here's the unfolded spectra. It's kind of noisy, unfortunately, because there's all these components. But you can see the green curve basically shows the whole spectra. The red didn't show up very well. Yeah. So there is a non-thermal component we have to fit to that data. And we have to include a Gaussian. And there's actually reflection features in this non-thermal component. This isn't actually, we're not fitting a power law. This does have a low energy cutoff, but it's sort of outside. It's right, these all fall off, like right about there. Okay, anyway, so what do we get for fits? Okay, well, the first thing I tried was fixing the mass and the inclination at the observed binary mass and inclination from Arose et al. And so because the alpha equals 0.01 model worked, I tried that one first. And so we get a reasonable chi-squared, a reduced chi-squared of 0.94. That's actually too good. And since the uncertainties on the data are just counting statistics, that's probably an indication that, as is often the case in X-ray data, we're oversampling the resolution. And so we're overestimating our independent degrees of freedom. So keep that in mind when evaluating the quality of fit anytime you see X-ray data. Anyway, so we get our best fit spin is 0, okay, and we actually get an upper limit of the spin on the spin of 0.25. Our model actually only extends down to a spin of 0 and up to a spin of 0.5 at this moment. We can actually calculate higher spins, but these are square grids, and so at the highest luminosities in the grid for the higher spins, the spectra gets so hot that our treatment of complementization breaks down. So for now, we can only evaluate these intermediate values of spin, at least on the square grid. But I'll work on increasing that at some point. Anyway, so the distance is reasonable. It agrees with the big uncertainty from the secondary. And the luminosities of these sources, inferred luminosities of the disks, range from about 0.06 to 0.6, so a decade in luminosity. You can see we actually calculate models up to L over L out of 1, but we don't include advection, so that's a little sketchy. Okay, so this is sort of in agreement with what we would expect from the last plot. Okay, so what happens if we let the inclination vary but keep the mass fixed? I'm going to keep the mass fixed in all the fits I show, but with the same alpha. Well, the chi-squared improves to 154 from about 159. Both are good fits, but actually, depending on what you think of chi-squared statistics, that's marginally statistically significant improvement, especially considered I don't really trust this degrees of freedom. But the fit results are substantially, the fit parameters are substantially different now. The best fit spin is now increased to the sort of close to the limit of our fitting range, and the spin is basically not constrained at all. And that's just because there's some degeneracy between the inclination and spin parameters. These are all, I should say, I'm reporting 90% confidence for one parameter here. So the distance has gotten larger. Basically, the normalization has decreased. And now the inclination, the best fit inclination is much lower. It's much more face on. And actually the upper limit, again, these are 90% confidence, one parameter. That's probably actually not even quite 2 sigma. But it's not even as good as a 2 sigma confidence error because there's actually correlations between all these values. But the inclination of the binary is 72 degrees, so that's a substantial discrepancy. Okay, and the luminosities here remain the same. Okay, so that's not as good, I guess, in some sense, as the last plot. So what do we get for alpha equals 0.1? Well, we get about the same chi squared. We again get a high spin. In this case, the distance of the source has dropped a little bit. The normalization increased. Again, the inclination is higher or is lower than the inferred binary inclination. Again, it's a substantial difference if you trust these statistics. and the luminosity drops, and that's again just because there's these correlations. A lower inclination increases the normalization on the spectra. Okay, so I mean, I guess on one hand, we're happy that they fit the data at all. That's an accomplishment. But it's sort of unfortunate that if we let the inclination float, we don't get the binary inclination, right? But there's actually sort of a twist to that. And I guess sort of going to ask if anyone could guess what that twist was with the hint that XT1550 is a microquasar. So anyone know what might? Okay.
Additional information might be available.
Yeah. We talked about this in a Rose's talk. Okay. So non-aligned jets are common in X-ray binaries. And 1550 is a microquasar. It does have a jet. And so superlumal ejections have been observed from the source with the apparent velocity being greater than 2c. This depends on the distance estimate. So it's at least 2c, if not greater. And so if you just plug into a ballistic model and say, what does that infer about the inclination? It requires the inclination to be less than 53 degrees. Okay, so there's definitely a discrepancy with the binary inclination. And so this isn't uncommon in black hole binaries. I think GRO-1655 is a pretty commonly cited source in this respect. And so it's usually assumed that the black hole spin differs from the binary orbit. And so the idea is the black hole spin, however it's born, via supernova explosion or whatever, it's born with a spin which differs from the angular momentum of the binary orbit. And so the time scale for that, those two align, is actually comparable to the age of the binary. So it's not unreasonable to have the situation. So what happens is like combination of lens tearing precession and viscosity align the inner disk with the spin of the black hole, and the outer disk is still aligned with the binary orbit. And so there's some transition radius, and this is called the Bardeen-Pedersen effect. And so it's quite conceivable in our source that the X-ray emission is coming from the inner disk. I mean, this transition radius is somewhat uncertain, but it's often inferred to be greater than 100 RG, which is greater than where most of this X-ray emission is coming from. But of course, then we have this problem that we're going to expect to have a torque disk. Our thin disk model doesn't include reprocessing. So there's still a potential problem there. But you know, this is at least, I think, an interesting question. Okay.
I think the 1659 is a pattern
speed. Yeah, it's not a. It's actually the inclination of the binary is closer than the inclination of the jets. Or it's more, the jets are farther away from us than if it was. All right, so I just want to summarize. So I was hoping, I guess I'm reasonably content that we can at least reproduce some of the spectral evolution observed in some sources, at least one. Okay. I mean, hopefully I've at least convinced you that these simultaneous fits, especially with priors, multiple epochs of the same source can derive at least marginally interesting constraints. And I mean, we're using RXT data, which is sort of the worst. I mean, it's the best because it has the most observations, but it's the worst in terms of spectral coverage. There's many observations of the same source with ASCA too, and you get much better, I think, constraints because you go down to lower energies. So this is, there's a lot of work to be done that yet. So it seems like spectral models are robust to some of these details of the underlying vertical structure, the dissipation profile, and the surface density, at least in these effectively thick limits. So that's good or bad. I mean, it means it's harder to get constraints on these physics. But I mean, it's potentially still, especially in these effectively thin regions, that these are going to be important. And I don't think we've addressed all the issues with the dissipation profile yet. I think there's more work to be done there. Okay, speaking of which, the most obvious thing to do is fit more models. I mean, I've basically shown you the first application of these models. There's tons of observations in RXT and ASCA, and I'm trying to work with collaborators observers to start doing this, and so I've already sent them off models, and hopefully they're getting started on that. And of course, once eventually we'll make these public, hopefully observers will be interested. So I can also examine the effects of self-irradiation. This is especially important if, you know, most of these sources are warp disks because of these non-aligned jets, or as implied by these non-aligned jets. We neglect coronal irradiation. That's potentially a uncertainty in our models, especially for some of these sources where there's a fair amount of coronal irradiation. One thing about this, even though we can do this for individual sources, it's very hard to parameterize the irradiation in the same way that we parameterize the effective temperature, the gravity parameter, and the midplane column mass. So it's much more difficult to do this interpolation method. So I doubt we'll ever be able to make models, fittable models that incorporate these effects. Not in any way that I'd be happy with. So we can also include line opacities. We don't include bound transitions, better atomic data. And one thing I'd like to do is more investigation of this dissipation profile. Currently, we're extrapolating to low column mass because Neil's grid zones are too thick. Okay. And so if you put a lot of dissipation, you know, depending on where the dissipation is, how much dissipation you have above the actual photosphere can have a significant effect on the spectrum. And then I've already done this. We've extended our models to large masses so it could potentially be used to fit intermediate black hole mass black holes if they exist. Although the ultraluminous X-ray sources tend to be somewhat power law dominated. We don't include coronal radiation, so our models might not be appropriate for that. Okay, that's it.
Finish right on time. So
yeah. Okay. You have a few questions. A few more. I just have one.
Okay.
Okay. I wonder again in terms of the importance of coronal radiation. You know, a real clue to that would be looking again at the variability timescales compared to the physical variation timescales and the speed of light. In other words, are the variations at, you know, at light speed or at viscous speed? I mean, that was why people were entertaining the notion of coronal irradiation in the AGN because of the rapid in-phase variability.
Yeah.
So, again, I guess it amounts to how do these, how does the variability timescale control the viscous or sound velocity timescale? Because the key, I mean, the external irradiation would be at light speed, and you see that. The fact that all the wavelengths will go up and down very rapidly in the phase.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, actually, with X-ray binary rates, how correlated the harder emission is with the soft emission. I mean, it certainly almost depends on the states, on what state you're in. But I'm not sure what the case is for the thermal dominated state. I don't know.
Yeah, there's actually a ton of information.
I mean, it's there, certainly.
Well, they have done functional energy to come in out of spectral density.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are lags and leads.
I just thought.
That's where the information is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of data, especially from RXT, on all of this stuff, but I haven't looked at it, so it's worth looking at. I don't know the answer, sorry.
So this model just works for the softer state alone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, potentially, I mean, so in the very hard state, for example, they fit. What they typically do is they fit this multicolor disk model and this power law model so the assumption is there is a disk there, right? But the thing is there is much more non-thermal emission inferred. And so we could potentially, you know, combine our model with some non-thermal emission just like they do. But I mean it wouldn't be justified because we don't include that coronal emission in our models, and so it'd be much better to model them self-consistently, right? I mean, you could do that, but I guess I wouldn't. I would advise against it. So yeah, it's essentially just useful for the thermal state, the high SOC state.
No, I don't want to keep anyone, but in the Gerlinski and Dome plot, you know, that you showed me the other day, mm-hmm. it's extremely impressive that some of them follow that T to the fourth relation. Mm-hmm. But what about the other really anomalous ones?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of good that these models fit some of the spectra. Sort of, but I mean, that actually wasn't my original hope, right? I wanted to constrain accretion to physics, right? So, I mean, it would be kind of bad if these really simple models just simply work for every source. But yeah, I mean, it's not clear whether, I mean, these are much harder, right? So it'll be interesting to fit sources like 1655. I mean, this actually rollover is then inferred to be advection coming into play, but this might just be due to the hardening that we saw in our spectra, but it'd be interesting to see whether you could actually fit it. And I have no clue. I mean, unfortunately, right? I mean, it seems to be going completely orthogonal, but they're all clustered together there. So you know, I mean, it's difficult to guess, right?
Actually, for that one, you have a good distance.
Oh yeah, these have the best. I mean, that's why this error is so small here.
Actually, why is there such a big error?
I'm guessing this is probably the inclination is important here. Certainly, the distance is well fractionally well measured because these are in the LMC.
Middle right, they have two different distance solutions.
Oh, this one, yeah, this GRO 1655. There's two different estimates for the distance. I think most people believe this one, but. I forget exactly the details of that. More questions?
Okay, let's thank Jamie here.